Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Beloved Jesus Christ,
Babaji,
Babaji,
Lahari Mahasya,
Lahari Mahasya,
Swami Sri Yukteswarji,
Swami Sri Yukteswarji,
Paramahansa Yogananda,
Paramahansa Yogananda,
Dearest Mother,
Dearest Mother,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
Saints and Sages of all religions,
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Sitting here wondering what to talk about tonight.
Talk about God.
That would be a shocker. So it's focusing inwardly, the images of Babaji and Lahari Mahasya came to me, such familiar ones, keeping me company through my year at Cloud Mountain. It's very interesting when you go the inner path, when you begin to deeply meditate. And of course, when we first begin to try to focus the mind inside, we run up against many obstacles. We have anxiety. We have running thoughts going after everything except for God. But if we persist, gradually, we bring the mind under control. And there's a wonderful moment that comes up that I think of, that in the beginning we take up meditation. Of course, meditation begins with concentration. But that's not the end of the story. Meditation really is designed, and the true meaning of the word is to become absorbed in God. But in the beginning, we take up concentration. We try to focus the mind on a single spot, on a mantra, on contemplation of God, whatever the technique, whatever the focus of our attention. And by doing so, we run up against the opposition of our unconscious mind, that we have an untrained mind, we have an undisciplined mind, and it's true for all of us. Even Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita says, how is it possible to control the mind? And Krishna says, well, it is difficult. But with practice and persistence, and ultimately with grace, we can learn to concentrate. And at this wonderful moment, from the time that we take up meditation, there's a transition that happens. And at that point, meditation takes us up. The reversal of current within the spine occurs. For most all of us, we live our lives, and all the energy, our life energy that we're given every day, is sent out through the senses into the world in order to perceive this world, in order to move this body in the world, to think, to speak, to do all the things and activities that we have in this world. But in this going the inner path, we reverse that life current from going through the afferent and the efferent nerves into the whole body system, and we draw it into the spine and up the spine into the higher centers. And as I say in the beginning, that's a point of concentration. We try to focus the mind in that way. But when this reversal of current comes, it draws our whole life current up the spine, most often to the ajna, sometimes to the sahasrara, occasionally to the heart center. And we're told any one of these three spots, the heart center, the third eye point between the eyes, the sahasrara at the seventh, the crown chakra at the top of the head, any one of those are fine to concentrate, to meditate upon, to become absorbed into. Well, at this third eye point, the ajna, which is the place that Mother most often asks us to focus our attention, as did Yogananda, and as is the tendency, the discipline within our Kriya lineage. You get there, many images, many lights will come to you, many visions, as you are lifted up into this inner state. Now, it's a very interesting thing in the spiritual path that things that at one time are a help to us on the path later on become an obstacle. For instance, being able to have a firm conceptualization that our life is about going to God, that we are involved in this inner path, and that we form very particular ideas about how that's to occur, how we are to make that transformation, can be a tremendous help to us in the beginning. Because all of us, in the beginning, are not in a realized state. Otherwise, there would be no path, there would be no reason for taking on a discipline or anything else. And the fact that we're in ignorance means that we're using this mind in order to focus the attention, in order to learn about what leading a spiritual life is. And so we make our best approximation, but we should always realize that no matter how strongly we feel about certain truths or certain principles that we are taught, it is only an approximation until we come into that fully realized state. So it is a theory, so to speak, but it is not a validated theory. It's not a proven theory until we come into that fully realized state. So we should, while we are guiding our lives by these principles, by these thoughts, we should also realize that those thoughts are not truth itself. Truth, when it is realized, comes from a different source than the mind. It's not something that we reason about. It's not something that we gain as a concrete conceptualization within the mind. It is something that comes intuitively, spontaneously, whole and complete to us. It is something that comes from the superconscious mind. And even then, if our minds have not been fully purified, we get glimpses of the truth. I remember many times when I would be lifted up in meditation and realization, and I would get glimpses of the truth. And as I came down from that state, as was inevitable at that point, because I had not earned the privilege to reside in that state at all times, but as I began to come back down, it was very similar kind of feeling to when you wake up and initially you remember a dream very vividly. And as you come back into worldly consciousness, that dream begins to fade from you, and all the details begin to blur together, and you can't remember quite how it all goes. And in the same way, this realized experience would come and be so absolutely clear when I was in that uplifted state. But as I started to come back down, it started to get less and less clear. And it became more of a memory of that realized state and the thoughts and the clarity that I had at that time than it was the actual experience. And this is true for all of us as we make our way on this path. We get lifted up into higher states of consciousness. There is some revelation that comes about. And through that revelation, we feel that we are in communion with the highest spiritual light that we have ever realized. But then we come back down and we come into our normal waking consciousness. And we bring with us the memory of that experience, but not the immanent reality. And a very great temptation to happen at that time is for the mind to begin to fill in the details. Because that clarity is not what it once was, we try to capture it, but we do that by mentally guessing or interjecting our own biases, our own thoughts about the path. And this explains why there can be very great souls, very wonderful souls, who are lifted up in experience, have revelations, and when they come back down into their normal waking state, they introduce these distortions on their experiences. And so there are people who say that I had this experience, God told me this, or I feel directed to do that. And we look at those things sometimes and we think, oh, God told you to do that. Because it doesn't resonate with higher spiritual truth. And yet that is their best understanding. And without questioning their own capacity for having the purified mind in order to keep that purity within their consciousness, they take those distortions and they run with them. And so we see people get into trouble at various times and lead the wrong path in their own lives. And we can see individuals who get carried away with their own belief system, and they can launch what they call a holy war. They can create great harm and damage, and they're not upholding Dharma at that point, but they are following a dark path. There may be others, and it is always possible that they are following their true light. And only by looking into the heart of an individual can you truly tell. But it should be a cautionary note for all of us that this absolute truth that we are striving for does not come all of a moment, that we must work for it. We must pay the price for it. We must be willing to be exacting in what we get from God. We must be willing to examine it and continue on our path until this mind becomes purified. And then at that point, when the mind is fully purified, we get what Mother called a straight pipeline to God. It is no longer being lifted up in consciousness and then coming back down. But rather it is a continuous feeding in from this superconscious mind. And we feel ourselves in union and communion, full communion, with that divine intelligence, power, uplifting presence and bliss. And as there's a co-mingling between this divine current that comes into our consciousness and our consciousness itself, finally, there is that full purification that happens, where the human mind and the divine mind become as one. That the human expression is an expression of the divine, and that is how we are all created. That is the true purpose for which we were born for. All these other things, our occupations, our families, our children, all the other things that we do in this life, are all an expression of divinity, but we have reversed the roles. The human ego has become the paramount aspect and focal point of our consciousness. and the divine has slipped into the unconscious. And many, many people are asleep to the divine. And they rest quite and dream quite contentedly in that asleep state. But when God within you is ready to awaken you, He resides right within your own heart, then He begins to awaken you. He brings you into those circumstances that are designed to transform you, to uplift you, to change you, into that divine expression. And as we do that more and more, come into that divine expression, we find that it is not like we are becoming someone else, but it is like for the first time we are truly becoming ourselves. We have reestablished that link between the human and the divine. And we find that far from the human being an obstacle to divine expression, rather we see that everything is a natural expression of the divine consciousness. All this world resonates in harmony with divine consciousness. And there is no such thing as animate and inanimate. The walls, the air that we breathe, every living thing, and everything is living. And in that state, we realize that. We come into that full consciousness of it. It is as if the air itself that we breathe is charged with a divine consciousness. The sunlight that comes down is divine consciousness coming to us as sunlight. Every aspect is charged with this divine current. And it is thrilling. It is uplifting. It is love made manifest. And it is wisdom itself. And we realize in that moment that we have always been that. In truth, there has never been separation except within our own conscious mind, where we have perceived it as such. And in that moment, we come to know who we truly are, what we truly are. And this is a magnificent time when there is a reunion between the Atman, the soul, and the Para-Atman, the supreme soul of the universe. And we find that there is no separation, there's only oneness. And our consciousness expands out and out and out. And at the same time it contracts in and in and in. And we find that being human and being divine are one in the same. And it is a marvelous thing. There's no station of life. There's no outward signs. There's nothing that would necessarily indicate this inner reunion. But the person within knows. They know because it is the most profound experience that they will ever have in their lives. It is the thing that they have come to do beyond all other things. Unless and until we make that the paramount reason for our thinking, for our speaking, for our doing, we cannot come into that realization because we have to, from a human standpoint, sacrifice everything that we are. Because it is this human aspect that seems to stand in the way. But when we come into that realization, we find that there is no obstacle between the human and the divine. They are one and the same thing. And this is perhaps one of the greatest things that Mother came to teach. She often said, I am fully human and I'm fully divine. And there's something in our brain that just has the most difficult time accepting that. We want to separate out life. We want to separate out the world. And we say, well, God is divine. He resides beyond this world. He is a supreme presence, but he cannot be this world. He cannot be me, most of all. And you see, that is the idea of separation, right there. Right there. The moment you say, the divine presence, the divine consciousness cannot be me, you have just separated yourself out from God. The moment you acknowledge that it is God itself who is expressing himself through you, as you, then you take the steps towards reuniting yourself with this divine presence. That's my talk about God. It's the best thing in town, I think. It's, sometimes we get these ideas in our mind that God is something for churches, or, the church lady, with the nose up in the air. But God is fun. God is life, all of life. And it's exciting. It's the most demanding. It's the most interesting. And it's the most life-charged endeavor that we could ever hope to embark on. As much as whatever area of interest captivates you, whether it be of sports or science or some kind of hobby or whatever that is, that's just a tiny aspect of God. And God is so much greater than that and more interesting than that. You think of the creative intelligence that it took to go, that went into creating this world just in itself, all the different aspects of it, how things operate, the intelligence that went into that is absolutely beyond belief. And to think about focusing your attention on that as being boring or staid or somehow won't be fulfilling, it's just silly. That's the ego whispering to us. That's the ego saying, oh, no, you don't want to go there. So really, it is the most marvelous thing that we can embark upon. Try it. You'll like it.
I was wanting you to give us a metaphor, because I was trying to talk to the kids about what God is like, a light bulb, like the energy going into the light bulb and how he animates us or whatever. And I couldn't come up with anything, but you just gave it to me with the idea of you want to have a nice meal or whatever, or you want to have something that's been created by somebody, and you think that that's fascinating, but how much more fascinating it is to spend time with that person doing that instead of just the outcome.
Right.
And the ego tells me, how could it be more interesting than all of this?
And for a child, and I don't keep up with the games and things like that, but this is, I'm sure I'm very dated on this, but if you think Game Boy is great, go to the creator of Game Boy and think how fun and interesting that would be, or whatever the next level is going to be. That's what God is like. He's just opening into this whole next level. And so whatever game, whatever area of interest you have, that's God, and God is, that's just a little tiny aspect. It's interesting to me that a scientist will spend, as he gets into a more and more specialized area of interest, that any scientist can spend an entire lifetime studying just the most smallest fragment of creation and find that they don't even begin to scratch the surface of it. There's a wonderful writing that, by a scientist that said, every time we make a scientific discovery, we discover that the universe is more complex and more unknown than what we knew it to be before. We thought we understood it better before we made this discovery. Make a discovery and we find out that we understand even less than what we thought we did. So with each new scientific discovery, our percentage of ignorance actually grows. So the more we know, the more we know we don't know. And so when they discover enough, they'll figure out what Socrates said a long time ago, that the beginning of wisdom is to acknowledge you don't know. And it's not a negative thing. It's not when you get into this thing with this infinite aspect of God, from a human ego standpoint, it says, oh, you mean I'll never know it all. And it can kind of be deflating in a way. But when you're spiritually attuned, it feels like the most fascinating thing, that you can continue to grow in God. Mother oftentimes talked about that realization of God is the reestablishment of that link of our union with God. But as long as we exist as any form of individuality, we'll continue to explore God's body. And so we just continue to go out and out and out, even though we have our full union with God. So union with God is not having all knowledge, it's having access to all knowledge through intuitive channels. But also, if you choose to at that point, to remain as an individual soul, you just continue to explore God's bodies in different levels. And I think that the lesson in that is that creation itself is not the source of the problem. It's that at some point we chose to let creation become between us and the Creator. And that it's that point of ignorance, is that idea of separation, as Mother used to say, that there's only one sin, and that's the idea of separation from God. And on all this, all the other errors hang. And once we close that gap, once we realize that there is no separation between ourselves and God, and that is the end of sin, so to speak, which the original terminology of sin was like the archer missing the mark. And so we no longer miss the mark because we're being guided by that intuitive knowledge instead of the mind, which is full of errors because it just doesn't have the capacity to know what the divine mind knows. So that's the healing of that idea of separation from God. That's what we're all about. Really, in this moment, if you could just fully receive and accept that you are in union with God, then you are. We don't need to make it harder or more difficult than what it is. But of course, our mind is deeply programmed to believe in that separation. And so we tend to draw it out, and we get there in gradual segments, piece by piece. We're willing to accept it in small measures, but it's more difficult to accept the whole thing in one fell swoop.
David, I see it. Catch 22 on the way to God. There's probably a bunch of them. It seems to me to walk the path successfully requires a very strong will.
Yes.
And the strong will to me speaks of a strong ego. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as you desire God or you want to go to God, you have this very strong ego constantly cropping up in very subtle ways. Sometimes you're even unconscious that it's not even an inner conversation, but it's like you said, you know, don't go to God. Mm-hmm. There's too many fun things to do.
Mm-hmm.
you know, don't go down that boring path or any of a thousand other things that your ego comes up with.
Right.
So here's this catch-22. It takes a strong will to go to God.
Even a strong ego.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
A strong sense of self.
Right.
And yet that's exactly what has to be killed.
Mm-hmm.
So in, on your to go to God successfully, you're going up against a giant.
Uh-huh.
A strong man.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we kill the rascal?
Well, there's a fundamental rule, and that is the ego cannot kill the ego.
Right. The mind can't kill the mind.
That's right. You'd like to think it could. Because
right.
Then it stays in control of the game. But that means that the ego stays in control of where it's going. So it can't happen. So there is this ascendancy up the path that requires great tenacity on our part, and actually a strong sense of self or a strong ego, as you were pointing out. If you don't have that, you don't have the organizing principle within your own mind to really focus your whole attention on some goal. And this is the greatest of all goals. So the wonderful thing about life is it's all preparation for this path. Every time we set out to accomplish something, it's all practice in accomplishing this greatest goal. And it's strengthening us for that. And oftentimes, Mother directed people into areas to strengthen their ego, into business, into occupations in life, to dress nicer, to present themselves better, and all with the idea of strengthening the sense of self. Because if you have a very weak conception of yourself, you're not going to make it on this path. So you do have to have a strong sense of yourself. But what happens is that as you strive and strive and strive and make great efforts, you finally come to this point where you realize that all that striving cannot get you to the goal. And yet, you can't short-circuit it because you have to have that sense, full sense of yourself. But as you bring your full energies into this goal, and then you come to realize, of myself, I am nothing. I cannot do it. And at that moment, the ego can surrender itself. Fully, completely. I really know I can't do it. It's not just something that I read in a book or I heard from somebody speaking. I know I can't do it myself. And at that moment, we can really let go and surrender. And that allows for divine grace to come in completely and sweep us up. And that teaches us. Then we stand back and we're a witness to this and we go, I could never organize this. I could never have the power to do what this divine power is doing within me. I'd never have the intelligence to know how to guide myself in the same way it does. And so the sense of self begins to relegate itself to the witness. It observes what the divine consciousness does through it. And that takes us the next step. And as Mother used to say, she says, I surrender my will, but I've never lost my free will. But my choice is to surrender my will to God. And that takes a very strong will.
So it takes a powerful person to surrender.
Yes. We oftentimes associate surrender with giving up. And that's actually a tamasic state. And when we're in this really active rajasic state, we oftentimes contemplate surrender as the tamasic state. It's somebody who is weak and they decided they can't cope with life and they surrender, they've given up.
It's the sattvic.
It is the sattvic. And that takes a lot of strength. It takes a lot of sense of self to be able to do that and to do it continuously. Most of us have had some experience of surrender. We get up against that wall, bang. Whatever that is, it's an emotional moment in our life, it's some circumstance in our life that really puts us up against the wall, and it brings us to our knees. We think, I cannot do this. I cannot do it. And most often, our mind turns to prayer. And in that moment of prayer, we say, God, I need your help. If I've never needed you before, I need you now. You really feel it. You're not trying on a pair of clothes, you know, to see how it feels. You're brought to your knees, so to speak. And in that moment, your ego collapses into the sense of full surrender. Your whole attention gets focused there, and you feel that grace come in and pick you up. What happens for most people then is they get saved from that situation, and the ego jumps right back on.
That's when you're on your knees, that's an easy time to surrender.
Yeah.
The hard time to surrender is when you're on top.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And I think Bob had a tape on Joe Goldsmith who said that, you know, it's possible for a millionaire to know that his real source of abundance is not in his bank account. It's possible, but it's probably rare. Because your mind travels that way. That's my source of abundance. I've got this big bank account. But for the person who really knows that divine power and consciousness is the source of their abundance, and to be in that millionaire status or to have that abundance and to know that your abundance comes from God is the wealthiest person in the world. But that would be the rarer person. That's not going to be everybody. So this idea of surrendered will really comes from a very, very strong ego. And actually, if you look at Jesus, at Buddha, at Krishna, at Yogananda, at Mother, they're very strong personalities. They are not people who kind of just fade away into the woodwork. Very strong personalities.
Well, it just occurred to me that every thought, or there's many sensations, many temptations to get you to not surrender.
Yeah.
You know, in the Bible, they use the story of Satan standing behind Jesus saying, you know, all this will be yours. But mm-hmm. we all get that every day.
Yes.
Just go away from God and you can have this pleasure and that pleasure and
right.
this pleasure.
That's exactly
so
right.
So it would take a very strong person to resist all that
yeah.
and surrender.
Yes. Exactly right. So everything that we do in the world is practice. It is preparing us for that, whether it's unconsciously or consciously. Everybody is practicing sadhana. Even if it's learning exactly what not to do. This is the opposite of what you ought to be doing. And through the pain and all the rest of it, we get it eventually. You know, as Elizabeth Hike says in an initiation book, eternity is long enough. It's just how long do we want to crack our head against that wall? And so God is just very willing to let us play in the field as long as we want to. But when we turn our minds back in this direction, then all these resources come in and support us in doing it. But we also have to face everything that we did. The outgoing path, going away from God. So it's like going out so far, you go up hills, you go down hills, you go up mountains, down mountains. At some point you say, I've traveled far enough, and there's just no airplane or helicopter to pick you up and take you back to the beginning. So you have to turn around on the exact same trail, go up those same hills, go down those same dales, go up those same hills, go down those same dales. Until you get back to the place of origin. And if you get halfway back and you kind of get swept in that outward stream again, there you go. There you go. And it's when you get that determination, it's when you get that absolute, this is the purpose of my life. It's the real purpose. And nothing else stands above it or gets placed as a priority before it. This is first in my life. And that's the kind of determination and focus we need. And it's really...
I thought there was a shortcut. Like, if you just surrendered it, then you got there. But all that means is that you just walk the path a lot faster and more determined. It doesn't mean that you just go zoom and you're to the end, does it?
Well, if you can focus your mind in that direction, then all those forces sweep you toward your goal. And so you get there much, much faster. And of course, we are given this great gift of Kriya that also accelerates because it focuses the attention on the spine and gets us directly where we're going to. But nevertheless, you still have to face those things. But it can be at an accelerated rate.
There'd be me or Papa going over those mountains.
And sometimes your life gets very thick, you know. You got a lot of things going on, and you think, my God, maybe I was better off before I got on this spiritual path. This is tough. But you're being taken at this accelerated rate back, and so you're just sloughing off things left, right, and center. You're taking care of them. And so if sometimes your life seems very, very condensed on the spiritual path, that's why. But we can amazingly remove lifetimes worth of patterns and difficulties in this one lifetime. And so even though our experience of it seems very troubled, seems hard, when we look at the whole picture and we see that really what we can accomplish in one lifetime is quite remarkable, quite remarkable. Then we see in total balance that we really were given great grace, even if it doesn't feel like it in the moment.
There are all sorts of examples of the masters of that accelerated pace. You know, look at Maharaji, look at Papa. And there's more.
What's difficult sometimes looking at somebody else's life is you never know where they start from. For instance, if you're going to take a trip to New York and you start out in New Jersey, that's a very different journey than if you start out in New Mexico, much less if you start out in Hawaii or Japan. So where you start the journey from, you know, sometimes somebody can stay in New Jersey and they look pretty darn wonderful there, but they make very little progress.
And that's why it's so important
not to compare. That's right. But when you focus your mind on your goal and you know that that's where you're going to, and you bring your full attention there, and you're connecting your mind to God, you're always reaching back for that connection, that's the opening that this grace comes through. Because grace, this is a very interesting thing that I was shown one time. Grace is constantly pouring to us. But why don't we get it? Or why does it seem like some people get it and other people get it? And what I was shown was that through our own free will, we close the doors to grace. Sometime in our past, we said, no, I don't want that. You know, it's like the small child who's the mother is trying to help guide the hand to do something, and the child says, no, leave me alone. I want to do it. They've refused grace. They've refused that help. And as souls, we've done that. And God doesn't interfere with our free will. So to reverse that, we have to put as much energy and intensity in our intention to open the doors as we did at closing the doors. So in our prayer to God and to reestablish that connection, and in our meditation, we have to create as much intensity in that as we did in some distant past where we closed ourselves. But grace is always coming to us, but God just will not trespass against our free will. And if we said no, and we set that boundary, and we said no way, God will not cross it until we reverse the orders, and we say, all right, this is what I want. But grace is never absent, but it allows it to flow. And that's why grace can be all around us. We can be swimming in a sea of grace and not be experiencing it. Or why some people seem to experience and other people don't. Or even why we pray for it sometimes and it doesn't seem to come. Because we have not generated enough of that intensity to match what we did when we closed the doors. I found that very interesting.
Spiritual physics.
Mm-hmm.
Another example is from close to home for us. Sometimes intellectual people say, you know, humanist approach too, to say that if that's the way this world is, I'm not interested in that God.
Mm-hmm.
It's closing the door.
Mm-hmm.
Because God can create any world he wants to.
Mm-hmm.
And it can look as strange as it does.
Mm-hmm.
But he does know what he's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was exactly the way it's supposed to be. It's a tremendous surrender.
Yeah. It really is.
The humanist in us does not want to say that.
Mm-hmm. It's difficult. We look at the tragedies from September 11th and we say, that's God. That's exactly the way the world's supposed to be. It takes, as Swami Satchitananda said about Papa, it takes a very great soul to be able to say that. It takes tremendous realization to come to that universal vision. And it is rare. It is not common. Even amongst great masters, that universal vision is rare. And I think we're very blessed in having Papa be able to write so articulately about it, to have Mother as such a wonderful demonstration of that universal vision. And when we survey the world of spiritual literature and spiritual masters, we find that it's not as common as we'd like it to be. But by focusing our mind on the universal vision, what a great shortcut that is. The world is God. And by opening your mind to that concept and beginning to think about it, you open yourself to the grace of that truth. And that grace can sweep you up and you can come to realize it. It is not far away. Great spiritual masters will make God feel very close, very noble. They may also say the difficulties of the path, but they will make you feel as if God is very attainable, very close, because they know it to be true. They know it to be true because they're experiencing it. They know they're swimming in a sea of it. And as one of my favorite quotes from Kabir, not an exact quote, a paraphrase, but that fish swimming in the ocean complain that they are thirsty. We're all swimming in an ocean of Ananda, of God. And we complain that we're thirsty. But the very air is charged with that Ananda. Our whole beings is charged with that bliss, with that presence. But who has the eyes to see, the ears to hear? Please pray after me. O Heavenly Father,
O Heavenly Father,
Divine Mother,
Divine Mother,
I feel the wonder and the beauty,
I feel the wonder and the beauty
of Thy glorious presence,
of Thy glorious presence,
surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
Are radiant with Thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with Thee.
Of my communion with Thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Blessed Spirit, I am He.
Peace.
Peace.
bliss,